Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the podcast. This is something I've been wanting to talk about for a while, and just finally getting around to it. And Wallis Simpson, also known as the Duchess of Windsor, is undoubtedly one of the most controversial figures of the 20th century. I mean, before all of the modern royal scandals that have taken place in recent times, there was Wallis. I mean, Wallis is an enigmatic figure and is still somewhat mysterious years later. She is either loathed or loved by the public and will probably never be fully understood. And Wallis's story is also pivotal to what's happening right now in the royal family and made it possible for someone like Meghan Markle to marry Prince Harry. Meghan Markle, someone who was either loved or loathed by the public. And to understand Wallis's story, we have to also understand what happened before she came along. So Queen Victoria had been queen for 63 years when she died in 1901 and was succeeded by her son, Albert Edward, known as Bertie. And Bertie was born in 1841, married Princess Alexandra of Denmark in 1863. The marriage arranged by Queen Victoria produced six children, five of whom lived to adulthood. And before his marriage, but after his engagement, Edward fell into a scandalous love affair with actress Nellie Clifton. So distraught was his father, Prince Albert, over the disgrace to the royal family that he confronted his son in a rage. And the affair was ended, but 2 weeks later, Albert fell ill and died of typhoid on December 14, 1861. Kind of coincidental, isn't it? So Queen Victoria blamed her son Edward for causing the stress that led to the death and never forgave him. So Edward continued to have many affairs throughout his marriage. Actresses Sarah Bernhardt and Lily Langtry, as well as Lady Randolph Churchill, which was Winston Churchill's mother, and Alice Keppel, who is the great-grandmother of Camilla, wife of Charles, the current Prince of Wales, were among his many mistresses. And after the death of her husband, Queen Victoria had fallen into a deep depression and withdrew from public life. So Bertie was allowed to represent her at official state events here and there, but not really given any responsibility in political matters. So he took his seat in the House of Lords as the Duke of Cornwall, but had few or no administrative duties. So as a result, he spent much of his time on the London social scene, eating, drinking, gambling, and acquiring a reputation as a playboy. So after Queen Victoria's death, Bertie was crowned King Edward VII in August 1902. The new King Edward had been the longest heir apparent, 59 years in British history. That record has now been surpassed by Prince Charles. So upon, you know, ascending the throne, he threw himself into his new role with energy and enthusiasm and restored the sparkle to the monarchy. You know, he had this outgoing personality and a likable character, and it won over much of the British population. And he used his fluency in French and German to shuttle across Europe and meet with major heads of state. He helped negotiate several important treaties and played an active role in reforming the military, pressing for an army medical service, and the building of modern battleships. So this Edwardian period from 1901 to 1910 was seen as the golden age for the upper classes in Britain. Think Downton Abbey. That's when this was happening, right? So though the rigid British class system held firm, you know, you had this rapid industrialization and an increased economic opportunity, creating conditions that allowed for more social mobility and with it, you know, more social change. There was a rise in socialism and attention to the plight of the poor, as well as a push for women's voting rights. And King Edward was very popular with most of the British people. By 1910, Edward VII's years of smoking 12 cigars and a pack of cigarettes a day, well, 20 cigarettes, I don't really think it was a pack then, but a pack now, created chronic respiratory illnesses, and during an official event in France, he fainted, and on April 27, 1910, he returned to London, gravely ill, and then on May 10th, Edward suffered a series of heart attacks and died. So he was buried at Windsor Castle on May 20th, 1910, in a funeral attended by a massive assemblage of royalty, And then Bertie's son, George, ascended the throne as King George V. And George V was the second son of Edward and Alexandra. And he was born on June 3rd, 1865. And, you know, he had a career in the Navy as the second royal son, and he wasn't expected to take the throne. In his early years, he was educated alongside his older brother, Albert, known as Eddie, by tutors and nannies. And at age 12, George and Eddie enrolled in the Naval Training Academy. And Eddie went to Trinity College. George stayed in the Navy. He was going to make it a career. And then, in 1892, Eddie died in an influenza pandemic. So then George, all of a sudden, he's the role of heir apparent, and he left the Navy. Now, Prince Eddie's sexuality and mental health have been the subject of speculation for many years. Rumors in his time linked him to a scandal involving a homosexual brothel, but there's no conclusive evidence that he ever went there or was homosexual. Some authors have also argued that he was the serial killer known as Jack the Ripper, but contemporary documents have not been able to conclusively tie him to the timelines or locations of the Jack the Ripper murders either. But what can be agreed upon is that Eddie clearly suffered from psychiatric and neurological issues during his life. So after Eddie's death, George was given the title Duke of York. Oh, going back to Eddie. You know, I did have a great blind item about Eddie that I talked about and revealed earlier. Go back and listen to it if you haven't, or read it. I can't remember what day it was. Somebody can probably put it in the comments. And, you know, I have wanted to explore the whole Eddie being Jack the Ripper thing. Because I do think, you know, it's possible. But anyway, after Eddie's death, George was given the title Duke of York. Along with a fast education in British politics, he became a member of the House of Lords. And then in 1893, George married his cousin, who I've talked about before, was Eddie's fiancée. It's Princess Victoria Mary of Teck, known as May, and then later Queen Mary. And during their marriage, they had five sons. So we have Prince Edward, Prince Albert, who is the current Queen Elizabeth's father, Prince George, Prince Henry, Prince John, and a daughter, Princess Mary. Now, their youngest son, Prince John, was diagnosed with epilepsy as a child and was largely kept apart from the royal family. His condition deteriorated as he aged, and he died after having a seizure when he was 13. And this child was somewhat removed from history books, never really spoken about by the family. By most accounts, George was a strict, critical, remote father with all his children. Sounds very old school British. But was especially critical of his heir and oldest son, David. And Queen Mary was also described by many as cold, remote, and an unavailable mother. So after the death of King Edward, George became king and immediately faced a constitutional crisis known as the budget controversy of 1910. So in an unprecedented move, Tories in the House of Lords rejected the budget proposal by liberals in the House of Commons. And George V threatened to create enough liberal nobles in the House of Lords to pass the measure, and the Tories gave in. George V's threat foretold future actions where he would support the middle class over the gentry. So then you had World War I. It broke out in July 1914, and George V took great effort to personally support the troops, visiting the front and military hospitals many times. On one such visit, his horse was startled and rolled over onto him, fracturing his pelvis and causing chronic pain for the rest of his life. And in 1917, in response to deep, deep anti-German sentiment in Britain, George V replaced the family's Germanic name with the name of Windsor, after the castle of the same name. And that same year, he made the controversial decision to deny political asylum to his cousin and ally, Tsar Nicholas, and his family after the Bolshevik Revolution. And, you know, looking back, probably not the wisest move. I mean, people in Britain were shocked, but he felt, you know, important to distance himself from the autocratic Russian regime. And then, you know, what happened was Tsar Nicholas and his wife and kids were all murdered by the Bolsheviks. And by the end of World War I, George V was one of very few European monarchs who hadn't fallen to revolution and war. It also kind of brought changes to his health. After the fall from the horse, you know, he started having these respiratory problems. His heavy smoking didn't help. And by 1925, he was diagnosed with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, which worsened as he aged. He never fully recovered, and in his final year of life, he was often administered oxygen. So on the evening of January 15, 1936, George complained of a cold, retired to his bedroom. It was apparent he was gravely ill, and the doctor was summoned. And the king slipped in and out of consciousness for 5 days. After receiving an injection of morphine and cocaine by the royal physician, he died on January 20, 1936. And the injection was given early in the night so that the king's death could be reported to the newspapers in time for the death news to be printed in the morning editions. So this gets us to George's son. Long name. Edward Albert Christian George Andrew Patrick David. Known by everyone close to him as David. He was born in 1894, and as was common practice with upper-class children of the time, Edward and his younger siblings were brought up by nannies rather than directly by their parents. One of Edward's early nannies often abused him by pinching him before he was due to be presented to his parents. His subsequent crying and wailing would lead his parents to send him and the nanny away. And this nanny was eventually fired after her mistreatment of the children was discovered, but it was too late. You know, the children suffered trauma from the nanny's abuse, including David's younger brother, Albert, who developed a nervous stutter, which plagued him all his life. David clearly felt this trauma, along with the fact that his parents were uninvolved and seemingly apathetic about his life. So yeah, David studied at Osborne Naval College, Royal Naval College, Oxford, and then in 1911, after his father's coronation, David became the Prince of Wales, joined the Navy, and then following the start of World War I, actually enlisted in the Army. And his assignments to safe positions on the front troubled him, causing him to announce, "What difference does it make if I'm killed? The king has 3 other sons. And upon his return to England after the First World War, the young prince took up his official duties and traveled throughout Britain and other parts of the world. I mean, this guy was good-looking, he was charming, and he became known in the American press as the arbiter of men's fashions. He was a fearless horseman, tireless dancer, idol of bachelors, dream of spinsters. He was one of the most photographed men on the planet and considered the most eligible bachelor in the world during this time. Now, David's womanizing and reckless behavior during the 20s and 30s worried the Prime Minister. It also worried King George V and those close to David. The prince's private secretary for 8 years during this period believed that, for some hereditary or physiological reason, his normal mental development stopped dead when he reached adolescence. Many theorize now that David may have had ADD, possibly even on the autism spectrum, and George V, being the stern, cranky dude he was disappointed by his son's failure to settle down in life, disgusted by his affairs with married women, and was reluctant to see him inherit the crown. He said, quote, "After I am dead, the boy will ruin himself in 12 months. And George V favored his second son, Albert, over David. You know, and he said, "I pray to God that my eldest son will never marry and have children." In 1930, George V gave David the lease of Fort Belvedere in Windsor Great Park. And there he continued his parties and relationships with a series of married women, including Frieda Dudley Ward and Lady Furness, the American wife of a British peer. If the name sounds familiar, Thelma Furness was the twin sister of Gloria Vanderbilt, mother of Gloria Vanderbilt, who was the mother of Anderson Cooper. So now let's have Wallace Simpson come on into the picture. And Wallace Simpson was born Bessie Wallace Warfield in June 1896 in Blue Ridge Summit, Pennsylvania. Her father was Tekel Wallace Warfield, the fifth and youngest son of Henry MacTier Warfield, who was a wealthy merchant described as one of the best known and personally one of the most popular citizens of Baltimore, who ran for mayor of the city in 1875. Wallace's mother was a daughter of a stockbroker named William Montague, and both the Warfield and Montague families are what would be regarded as old aristocratic, I don't know why I couldn't say it for a second, southern families. And Wallace was named in honor of her father and her mother's elder sister, and was called Bessie Wallace, and until sometime during her youth, the name Bessie was dropped. And Wallace quipped later, there were enough cows named Bessie to go around. So her parents were married in 1895, and which suggests that she was conceived out of wedlock. So, and then her dad died not even a year later, November 15th, 1896. So for the first few years of Wallace's life, she and her mother were dependent upon the charity of her father's wealthy bachelor brother, Solomon Davies Warfield, who was the former postmaster of Baltimore and later president and CEO of the Continental Trust Company and the Seaboard Airline Railway. So initially they lived with him, that he shared with his mother. And then eventually Wallace and her mother were forced to leave Uncle Solomon's home after he began making sexual advances to Wallace's mother and holding her hostage financially, since they were totally dependent on him for financial support. And so in 1901, Wallace's aunt was widowed, and the following year, Alice and Wallace moved into her house in Baltimore, where they lived for at least a year until they settled in an apartment and then a house of their own. And then in 1908, Wallace's mother married her second husband, who was the son of a prominent Democratic Party boss who later also died suddenly. So you have Wallace, you know, growing up in, you know, 1910, she gets confirmed, and then she went to the most expensive and exclusive girls' school in Maryland, and there she became a close friend of heiress Renee DuPont of the DuPont chemical family. And Mary Kirk, whose family founded Kirk Silver. Wallace, according to everybody at school, you know, they said that she was bright, brighter than all of us, and that she had made up her mind to go to the head of the class, and she did. She was always the best dressed at school. And, you know, a biographer said, you know, the Wallace's jaw was too angular for her to be counted beautiful. You know, her fine, bright violet blue eyes, long, curly, dark hair, petite figure, all of these things, she had many admirers, both young and old. Well, in 1916, Wallace met Earl Spencer Jr., a dashing U.S. Navy pilot. And the couple married that November, after only knowing one another for a few months. So Wynne, as her husband was known, was an abusive alcoholic. And over the course of their marriage, he was stationed in San Diego, Washington, D.C., and China. And their marriage has been the subject of a lot of speculation. But one thing is known. Wynne was abusive physically, and it became worse when he drank. And one incident that Wallace spoke about years later involved a severe beating, after which she was locked in a bathroom by Wynne for almost 24 hours. Friends who knew Wallace and Wynne during the time remarked that Wynne was very jealous and would become enraged when Wallace, who, you know, was described as this Southern belle, was flirtatious or engaging with other men. And Wallace herself described Wynne as becoming unhinged when they were together in social situations where other men were present and interacting with his wife. Wynne, who refused to be interviewed about Wallace in later years, was married and divorced a number of times after his divorce from Wallace. These other wives also accused him of alcoholism and beating and battering and abuse. It's also been reported that Wynne beat Wallace so severely that she was rendered sterile after miscarrying following a beating. So, you know, it can be safely said that Wallace was likely traumatized by the beatings she received at the hands of her husband. And when their marriage finally broke down for good, Wallace left Wynne and traveled extensively throughout China alone, which was pretty rare for a woman during that time, especially since China was, you know, in upheaval politically. And they were finally divorced in 1927, and it didn't come easily. And Wallace was told by her wealthy Uncle Solomon that she'd be disowned for doing so, even though he knew about the beatings that Wallace had endured. This is the way things were back then, and it took a lot of courage on Wallace's part to leave this marriage and defy her family this way. So by the time her marriage ended, dissolved, she had become involved with Ernest Simpson, and he was an American shipping executive who was a dual citizen of the UK, and he was, you know, a former officer in the military. And he had divorced his first wife, Dorothea, with whom he had a daughter named Audrey, to marry Wallace on July 21st, 1928. So this is marriage number two for Wallace. And they get married in London. And Wallace had telegraphed her acceptance of his proposal from Caen, where she was staying with her friends, Herman and Catherine Rogers. And the Rogers were close friends of Wallace's, going back to when she lived in and was traveling in China. And Simpson, you know, he was kind of dull, but he was nice. And he was financially secure. And he was a cultured, well-read man. And, you know, he had a family with superb social connections. He was the perfect husband for a woman like Wallace, who had struggled with instability and abuse and poverty in her past. So they set up home, temporarily, in a furnished house with four servants in the upscale Mayfair district in London. And Wallace, hey, people in London loved her. She was an excellent hostess. She had great dinner parties where there's great food and company. And in 1929, she sailed back to the U.S. to visit her terminally ill mother. And during the trip, because this is 1929, her investments and inheritance from her Uncle Solomon were wiped out in the Wall Street crash. And her mother also died penniless on November 2nd, 1929. So you have Wallace goes back to England. The shipping business is still doing great. So they moved into this large London apartment with a staff of servants. And it was through a friend that Wallace met Thelma, Lady Furness, at the time the mistress of David, Prince of Wales. And so in 1931, Lady Furness introduced Wallace to the prince. And then between 1931 and 1934, he met the Simpsons at various house parties, and Wallace was presented at court. Now, Ernest was beginning to encounter financial difficulties due to the Great Depression. And because the Simpsons were living beyond their means, they had to let many of their servants go. And poverty was this kind of underlying and ongoing fear in Wallace's life going back to childhood. She had this almost pathological need to feel secure financially, which created a big conflict in her internally, since she also had a very nonconformist, outspoken, and almost rebellious side to her personality. You know, security and rebellion just didn't mix well for women during these times. Wallace liked to push the envelope, which was also apparent in her sharp, you know, sarcastic wit and well-informed opinions. And she wasn't afraid to flirt. She wasn't afraid to scold, debate, laugh at, and disagree with men. Many men found those traits to be very attractive, including David, the Prince of Wales. This was in huge contrast to British women who were taught to be polite, deferential, and have no opinions, especially around the aristocracy. And in January 1934, while Lady Furness was away in New York City, Wallace became the prince's mistress. And before she departed London, Lady Furness had instructed Wallace to please take care of the little man. David was referred to by many as the little man, both because of his short stature, but was also whispered to have been lacking in genital endowment. Little did Lady Furness realize how seriously Wallace would take her request. When confronted about his affair with Wallace by his father, the king, David denied it, despite his staff seeing them in bed together as well as evidence of a physical sexual act. So Wallace had soon replaced Lady Furness, and the prince also distanced himself from his former lover and longtime confidant, Frieda Ward. So Mrs. Ward realized she'd been cut off by the prince when she called the Buckingham Palace switchboard after the sudden illness of her daughter, and when the operator answered, he was nearly in tears after being forced to inform Miss Ward that the prince no longer wanted to speak to her after 16 years of being involved with her. So by the end of 1934, I mean, David was obsessed and besotted with Wallace. He loved her take-charge manner, irreverence toward his position, and he became slavishly dependent on her. This sounds so much like, you know, Meghan and Harry, minus all the marriages and affairs and things like that. Well, marriages on Harry's side, not on Meghan's side, because she's got a lot of marriages and affairs. And according to Wallace, it was during a cruise on a private yacht in August 1934 that she fell in love with David. At an evening party in Buckingham Palace, he insisted on introducing Wallace to his mother, and his father was outraged, primarily on account of her marital history, as divorced people were generally excluded from court. And David showered Wallace with tens of thousands of dollars in jewelry and in cash. And in February 1935, and again later in the year, he holidayed with her in Europe. His handlers kind of became increasingly alarmed as the affair began to interfere with his official duties. Again, gosh, sounds a lot like Meghan and Harry, doesn't it? Meanwhile, Ernest Simpson, remember, because Wallace is still married. Ernest had been flattered by David's attention towards his wife, but had now become estranged from Wallace. Because David would call their apartment constantly and was needy and demanding. He would drop by unannounced at all hours of the day and night to the marital home. And Ernest separated from Wallace and left to live elsewhere, eventually entering into a relationship with Mary Kirk, who's Wallace's old friend, the one I said, you know, the heiress to the Kirk silver fortune from Maryland. Just all a big circle, isn't it? So then on January 20th, 1936, George V died, and David ascended the throne as King Edward VIII. Well, the next day he broke royal protocol by watching the proclamation of his accession from a window of St. James's Palace in the company of the still-married Wallace. It was becoming apparent to the court and to government circles that the new king, you know, slash emperor was serious about marrying Wallace. And the king's behavior and his relationship with Wallace made him unpopular with the conservative-led British government, as well as distressing his mother and his brother Bertie. So, the British media at this point, you know, they're remaining deferential to the monarchy. So no stories of the affair were reported in the domestic press. But, foreign media widely reported their relationship. I mean, American papers were full of photos and stories about the couple. The British elite, who knew all about the king's liaison, mostly deplored it, scornfully branding Wallace that woman. Winston Churchill, who was in Parliament at the time, was more indulgently disposed. He called her the king's cutie. You know, it's important to understand that the monarch of the United Kingdom is supreme governor of the Church of England. So at the time of the proposed marriage and until 2002, the Church of England disapproved of and would not perform the remarriage of divorced people if their former spouse was still alive. Well, so constitutionally, the king was required to be in communion with the Church of England, but his proposed marriage conflicted with the church's teachings. Additionally, at that time, both the church and English law only recognized adultery as a legitimate ground for divorce. Since Wallace had divorced her first husband on grounds of mental cruelty, there was a possibility that her second marriage, as well as her prospective marriage to David, you know, would make her a bigamist if her first divorce was challenged in court. And the British and Dominion governments believed that a twice divorced woman was politically, socially, and morally unsuitable as a prospective consort. I mean, Wallace was perceived by many in the British Empire as a woman of limitless ambition who was pursuing the king because of his wealth and position. Again, the same thoughts, you know, are put towards Meghan and Harry. So by the time the situation had come to a head, Wallace had already filed for divorce from her second husband, Ernest, on the grounds that he had committed adultery with Mary Kirk. And the preliminary decree was granted on October 27, 1936. So in November, the king consulted with the British Prime Minister about a way to marry Wallace and stay on the throne. And the king suggested a morganatic marriage where he would remain king, but Wallace would not be queen. But this was rejected by the Prime Minister and the Prime Ministers of Australia, Canada, and South Africa. If the king were to marry Wallace against the Prime Minister's advice, the government would be required to resign, causing a constitutional crisis. You know, Wallace's relationship with the king had become public knowledge in the United Kingdom by early December, and she decided to flee the country as the scandal broke and was driven to the south of France in a dramatic race to outrun the press. For the next 3 months, she was under siege by the media at a villa near Cannes at the home of her old friends. And at her hideaway, Wallace was pressured by the king's lord-in-waiting to renounce the king. And on December 7th, 1936, this lord-in-waiting, Lord Brownlow, read to the press her statement, which he had helped her draft, indicating Wallace's readiness to give up the king. However, you know, Edward was determined to marry Wallace and repeatedly threatened to commit suicide if she did not agree to the marriage. And Wallace's lawyer stated, you know, that Wallace was ready to do anything to ease the situation, but the other end, Edward VIII, was determined. And this seemingly indicated that the king had decided he had no option but to abdicate if he wished to marry Wallace. So the king signed the instrument of abdication on December 10, 1936, in the presence of his three surviving brothers, the Duke of York, who would ascend the throne the following day as George VI, and his other two brothers. And special laws passed by the parliaments of the dominions finalized David's abdication the following day, or in Ireland's case, one day later. On December 11, 1936, David said in a radio broadcast, "I have found it impossible to carry the heavy burden of responsibility and discharge my duties as king as I would wish to do so without the help and support of the woman I love." So David left the UK for Austria, where he stayed at the home of Baron and Baroness Rothschild. And David had to remain apart from Wallace until there was no danger of compromising the granting of the final decree in her divorce proceedings. So upon her divorce being made final in May 1937, she changed her name back to Wallace Warfield, her maiden name, and the couple were reunited in the south of France on May 4th, 1937, married in June, and Wallace was 40 years old. So some letters from Wallace, which were published in a recently published book about her, reveal some of her true feelings about the situation she found herself in with David. In a particular, a trove of 15 letters written in Wallace's own hand, postmarked in 1936 and 1937, and addressed to her former husband, Ernest, indicate that Wallace had wanted out of her relationship with David for years. She said, "The man is exhausting." It's clear that at first, you know, Wallace really relished this dalliance, and her husband turned a blind eye since both were eager to profit from the social boost it gave them. But neither had expected the affair to take a serious turn, but they were powerless to resist once the obsessed David made up his mind. In October 1936, when his determination to marry Wallace became clear, Ernest wrote to his wife, "I know that somewhere in your heart there is a small flame burning for me. Guard it carefully, my darling, and don't let it go out." And a month later, Wallace told Ernest she was leaving the country to put distance between herself and HM, who was His Majesty, hoping the affair would blow over, but no such luck. And while holed up in the Villeneuve Khan, Wallace listened to the abdication speech on a radio. And in a letter to Ernest soon after, she blamed the newly created Duke of Windsor, Peter Pan, she called him, for this mess, and asked, "Oh dear, wasn't life before lovely, sweet, and simple?" I mean, there's no doubt that Wallace was a social climber, tactless at times, probably a gold digger. But she was also a helpless pawn for a man who probably never wanted to be king in the first place. Many historians now believe that Wallace did not want to marry her royal lover, but that she was very likely used as a scapegoat by schemers in the British government who regarded David as unstable, irresponsible, and a Nazi sympathizer. I mean, even some palace staffers considered him mad. One said one time, "We shall have to lock him up." And the royal family's doctor, like I said before, was convinced that the prince's moral development had stalled when he was in his teens. And more interesting still was that in spite of David's numerous affairs, there's no evidence to indicate that he ever fathered any children with his lovers, which is very odd. So many in his circle believed him to be sterile. Now, David's detractors, including the prime minister, sniffed an opportunity with Wallace. The king's obsession with Wallace was so great, they thought, that if he could be persuaded that he was constitutionally barred from marrying her, he might willingly transfer the crown to his more level-headed brother, Bertie. And the factual basis of the constitutional threat was kind of shaky. It was a risky ploy because the king was so popular with the British public. You know, he was a pinup figure for millions. But it worked. The British political system, you know, didn't like David because he regularly spoke out about poverty and workers' rights issues. And the other very important thing about the Wallace story is that her marriage to David spawned one of the most legendary feuds in modern times between Wallace and Queen Elizabeth, a.k.a. the Queen Mother. There's no doubt that Elizabeth was deeply fond of her brother-in-law and was amused by him. Her attitude to him was teasing and intimate. "Darling David," she wrote in a letter, "you are very, very naughty but delicious." Her relations with two of his mistresses, Frieda Ward and Thelma, Furness, were friendly, both were firmly married and neither harbored aspirations to marry the Prince of Wales. By contrast, Wallace, although divorced and married for the second time, was seen from the beginning by the Queen Mother as a threat to the monarchy, and the two women disliked each other from their earliest meetings, with Wallace deriding the Queen Mother as the Dowdy Duchess and nicknaming her Cookie, referring to what Wallace felt was the Queen Mom's resemblance to a fat Scottish cook. And then David got all angry when his brother, the new king, refused to grant Wallace the title of Your Royal Highness. Gosh, this just sounds just so similar to what's happening now. So following the abdication, embittered by exile, by the fact that no member of the royal family attended their wedding in 1937, and by Wallace being illegally and unconstitutionally deprived of the title Her Royal Highness, which was hers by common law, the Windsors' attitude to the Queen Mother, whom they blamed for all of these reverses, became increasingly hostile. Several women close to the Queen Mother said in later years that Elizabeth was actually in love with David and only settled on his brother Bertie as a second choice after he proposed to her several times. Now, in the next episode, part two, we're going to dive into David and Wallace and their ties to Nazi Germany and their later life in exile. All right. I will talk to you guys next time.